Ole Damgaard is our guest. This is the second hour of our part four in our series. This is the last part of this series that we've been detailing the assassination of Olof Palme. And we were just basically talking about Team A, Team B, two different agendas going. The plan from the Palme camp is obviously to get him out of the country pretty much, have him live out his life in another region of the world in hiding, posing as dead pretty much. So we're trying to get to obviously what actually happened here then, Ole, if there's any potential conflicts between Group A and Group B and what actually happened. We still don't know the fate of Olof Palme.
No, true, true. So just so people are aware that Team A, which was secretly ordered by Olof Palme himself, are not aware of that it's a setup, that it's a stage assassination, not a real one, a fake one. So they really think that it's an actual hit they're doing. And the headquarters that they've been giving is sixth floor underneath the fire station, the Johannes fire station, which is about 150 meters from the site of the assassination. It's six floors down in the ground, and it's where I think up until today it's used for the big alarm center, what do you call it, the 112 or 911?
Yeah, the emergency
central in Stockholm. Yeah. It's been used for that, but it used to be part of a secret net of tunnels that are under the whole of Stockholm. Is 628 kilometers of tunnels on the level underneath the subway, where there's a lot of military activity going on, and also where the whole Stay Behind movement was organized to bring out any type of high-profile person in the case of an invasion. The king, the politicians, rich people, bankers, whatever. If the country would be invaded, then they would be brought out through these tunnels out of Stockholm to Norway and then to London, where the resistance would be organized to take care of the invasion.
In other words, everyone that is part of the upper crust elite of an egalitarian social democratic society.
There you go, exactly. Yeah. And many of these buildings, like the parliament and the royal castle and so on, they are connected with these tunnels.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, there's so many, sorry to interrupt there, but there's so many of these cities in Europe that has these catacomb, you know, like just riddled with them, and still people just don't even know that they're there. They don't even know the activity that goes on underneath their feet when they're running around in their cities. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah, and there's even military people doing their duty down there. They're called city militaries and city soldiers.
Yeah, I mean, even just a brief anecdote on that. I was on a tour of all abandoned networks of or underground bases rather on the West Coast. Many of these had actually been turned into like server facilities, server rooms and stuff like that. But there was actually a lot of them riddled throughout, and there was even pamphlets and stuff lying around that was like goes back to the 80s and something like that. You know, there was like literally they just left up and walked out of there, and I couldn't help to think as I saw all this, I wonder what they have these days. I wonder if they're even further deeper underground. You know what I mean? It's pretty crazy. Yeah. Anyway, please proceed, Ulla. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, so if we call it the Olof Palme team, Team A, and the NATO team, Team B, let's call them like that. The Olof Palme team had decided to do the hit somewhere close to the Skandia building, which used to be the headquarters of Stay Behind, because the access they had going down into this building and down into the network, they could just disappear. And on the back side of the back of the Skandia building, there was one door left open, unlocked by a security guard, right around the time of the assassination. Okay, so we have the whole assassination set up with a prepared patsy. The guy that they wanted to blame this whole assassination on, he was called Wilhelm Kram. It was an alias. His real name was Josef Fritzl, and he was later There was a later, some years later, a major scandal in the newspapers about this man because he had held his daughter imprisoned in Austria.
That's
in
right.
The basement for, I think, 24 years, and he had like five children with her and one abort, things like that, totally unreal.
Yeah.
So he was the guy that was prepared as a patsy, and before in the afternoon before the assassination, Hans Holmér, who was on his way up to an international ski competition called the Vasaloppet, he came into the police station in Stockholm and just said, "Now Olof Palme has been threatened to his life again. He threatened me as well. It's this damned crazy Austrian Wilhelm Kram who's going to do it," and so on. So his other colleague said, "But shouldn't we go and get him? I mean, it's the weekend." And Olof, Hans Holmér just said, "No, let's wait until Monday." But what he actually did was he sort of put the idea there, you know, so that when they would take him later that evening, these policemen would be totally prepared and also could what do you call it? They could also tell that he had been threatening Olof Palme before and so on.
Weekend, huh? I guess the union didn't allow them to work overtime. Let's get him on Monday first thing. It's all good.
Let's get him on Monday. It's only a murder threat, so yeah. Okay. Anyway, so the patsy was prepared, and they had prepared evidence and so on for him. And the idea was that he would be picked up at Slussen, which is a little south of the center, or it's actually in the center of Stockholm, but maybe a kilometer from the assassination site. So he was prepared, and he was told to stay there. They had set up some kind of a meeting that he went there to meet someone, but the whole idea was that he would be picked up right after the assassination and then taken in, and they would close the case within overnight, and nobody would ever look into it. This is also what quite a few policemen thought that had happened, and they tried to get the son of Olof Palme to point him out in a line with photos. He didn't look like anything that anyone that Morten had seen outside the cinema and so on. So, but let's get back to that later. Anyway, so we have the whole control center filled with Craig Williamson, his people from different security agencies, international agencies, lots of people in black suits that no one really know who were and so on. Preparing for this assassination. We have the backup. There were three escape cars. There was one white Volvo 242. There was one light blue Volkswagen Passat that was owned by Heine Hyman, the South African agent I told you about before.
Yeah.
And there was one red Ford Fiesta that was most probably driven by Michael Townley and with Stefano Della Chiaia in. So there were three alternative escape cars, and there were one car that was driven by a Swedish police chief, and the whole back seat of this car was filled up with technical equipment, and most probably that car was driving around to amplify the signals from the commando bunker to the different cars, because of the high buildings in central Stockholm, they had problems receiving.
Mm.
So also when Olof Palme and his wife came out from the cinema and started walking down the street, they were followed by people with walkie-talkies, and alternative shooters were positioned in different situations and so on. So he was walking down towards the Scandia building where he was later assassinated. And at that time, we had the Palme team in place. These are the walkie-talkie people we're talking about. These are also the people, the De Guerima man. His real name is Antti Avsan, who is today a moderate politician. He was standing at the corner just where he was about to get shot. And you have these three escape cars, and you got several police cars, police vans that were not even registered, some of them this evening, but they were driving around in the area just preparing so that nobody would get involved, that they would be able to stop any private person to try and stop them or somehow mess it up. So the whole, the date was also important, the date that they had chosen, because for one thing, this elite, Illuminati elite that we're talking about, who's behind this assassination, they're very much into numbers, and that is why many of these, like 9/11 or other things, that I don't understand why these numbers are so important to them, but it comes up again and again that the date and the time and whatever has very much to do with numbers. And apparently this 28th of February, the numbers for that day was very good as well. It was a Friday, it was the last Friday of the winter holiday, the so-called Sportlovet. So most of the parliament and the king and many other people were out of town, and thereby also getting plausible denial, getting, even if some of them had been involved in this, they had an alibi from when it actually happened. So they were out of town. You had also, just before the assassination happened, there was a fire started in one of the industrial areas, which was a diversion away. So journalists from the newspapers in Stockholm went to cover that fire instead of being on standby in central Stockholm. Then also, in the evening of the assassination, there was, like I told you before, Olof Palme was being attacked in different ways before his so-called death by some scandals. And one of them was a tax scandal that about him, his son, him having held a speech in the States and without any payment, he was not allowed to get payment for the speech. And then what happened was that instead of that, his oldest son was given a scholarship there. And Jan Guillou, which we have been talking about before, who has a very, very strange background, connected to different foreign security services, and also who's been on the payroll of Säpo, the Swedish security police, and so on. Mm. He was the one who set Olof Palme up with this big scandal about this tax, and that was something that really concerned him during the last months. But at 6 o'clock that evening, he was shot just after 11 in the evening. But at 6 o'clock that evening, somebody broke in to the tax offices and deleted his whole file where all of these things were, that could be used against him. That whole file was deleted at 6 o'clock anonymously, which is a bit strange, yeah, to say the least.
Oh, yeah.
Also, it seems like there was a whole propaganda machine built up so that as soon as Palmer was officially dead, all of these posters with a black a band on the corner and all of this, these things where he looks like a saint, all of these perfect photos, they were all, most of them were already printed before he was even shot. And they, so as soon as he was shot, boom, it was out there. Wow. And the whole story, the whole thing about how amazing he was internationally, no one had any idea, or very few people in Sweden had any idea of his international involvement. But it was just on stand and then pumped out in media as soon as it came out. So you had all of this PR, public relationship machine, just pumping out this propaganda as soon as he died.
Well, another thing people have to understand who don't know Sweden or the history of Sweden is we have subsidized media. You know, they're getting government money. It's very, very centralized run. There's very few alternative voices. I mean, even today, although this is on the rise, it's still, you know, fairly low. And so this is the climate when you know, mommy and daddy government gives you the information, that is what you believe. You know, they have everyone pretty much right under their wing, and very few you know, privateers or people who actually can, you know, investigate on their own. And as you've clarified as well, Ola, those few who have and did ended up with ruined careers, if not even with the loss of their own life. So there you go.
Yeah, it's a smelly story, to say the least. Anyway, also in the morning of this day, Olof Palme's bodyguards were asked to step down. Officially, Olof Palme himself said that he asked them, or he it's claimed that he asked them to take the rest of the day off, then he would go to the cinema on his own with his wife and so on. Earlier that day as well, he went to get a new suit, and that suit can play a certain role. I'm not sure if it did, but when it comes to whatever clothes have been put forward as evidence and so on. Just as there's strange things around the fur of Lisbeth Palme, there might be strange things around this suit of his. Hmm. Also, I need to go back and also say that if you look at things like the Kennedy assassination, 9/11 and so on, if you go to Wall Street or the banking center and you go to the stock market, you will see, if there is a conspiracy, you will see how there's like, you can see the development going on right before it happens, that people who know are taking advantage of it, putting a lot of stock options in, making them make millions and millions as soon as the attack happens. Mm. And also they prefer doing it on a Friday because then they can shut down the stock exchange and not open until Monday. And while during these days, they can put everything in place to their own benefit. And this is exactly what happened in Stockholm also. It was the almost the all-time high on the stock market in Sweden when he was murdered. It's strange that a murder can do that thing, but that was... And one of the people who made the most was Erik Penser, who was deeply involved with the Bofors, the whole Bofors thing.
Yeah.
Also, his company was called Yggdrasil. And if you remember the meeting I told you about in Wiltshire, where the NATO and all of these people met, they met at a place arranged for and called Yggdrasil as well. So
yeah, that's right.
At the same time, there were airborne troops around in Sweden, police and military troops in helicopters, on, as far as I've been able to figure out, on standby should there be any riots or anything like that. It was exactly the same in the Kennedy assassination, where there were big military planes circling the states, totally prepared. If should there any riots occur, they could go down right away and stop it.
Yeah.
This was these helicopter base was from the S1 air base, as far as I'm able to figure out. Also, we had there were two ambulances this evening. One was to pick up the double, and the other one to go and possibly take one to pick up Olof Palme, and the other one to bring the dead double to or the double to the hospital.
Do you know at this stage who that double was? Where they got him from? What happened there?
There's a big question around that. I know I went to one meeting once, and the double that was used in a film called The Contract.
Okay. Anyway,
double that they used in that movie, he went to one of these private investigator meetings, and he claimed that he was situated in a car together with his wife 5 meters from the place when Palme was shot. He said, I don't want to say anything more, but I was there.
Okay, the last contract, is that the one you're talking about?
The last contract, that's the one.
Okay.
The last contract, yeah.
Yep.
We have the Palme team who are arranging a real hit, but not knowing that it's fake ammunition, okay? Then we have the NATO team, and the NATO team are following right behind the Palme team, with the Palme team not knowing, okay? So what the NATO team did was that they put a sniper on a building on the other side of Sveavägen. so that he could cover. There was a radio operator and a sniper. And so that should the shooter down on the street level from the Palma team fail in any way, the shooter on the other ceiling from the other side of the road, he would do finish off the work, finish off the job. Mm-hmm. And there were one person who had infiltrated the commando bunker so that he knew was what was going on as well. So when Palma and his wife came, there's quite a lot that shows that he was exchanged for a double just before the shooting. Because right in front of the entrance to the Scandia building, there's a triangular pillar with for ads. And what the witnesses said was that Palme went on the outside. And when you look at that, if you're there, it's very close to the edge of the pavement, and the pavement is quite wide. So it's very strange that you would walk on the outside. But some witnesses have said that Palme walked on the outside and then back in on the pavement, meeting up his wife.
Okay.
That is right in front of the entrance to the Scandia building, where you could go down and into the tunnels. My theory is that he was, Olof Palme was met by Ebbe Carlsson at that place, and the double was standing in the shadows behind this triangular pillar, ad pillar, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Because also when you listen to what witnesses have seen, witnesses that met the couple, they said that they met them at a building at a certain time, and then if you count down time, count back time wise to when the assassination happened, and also when you see how long that witness continued to walk before he heard the shots, there's a time difference of almost half a minute that Lisbeth Palme or no one has been able to explain, because they, according to Lisbeth, they walked all the time. They crossed the street, they looked in a shop window, then they met this witness, and for them to walk to where he was actually shot, they should have been there like half a minute earlier. And also, at least one witness have seen them, what he said, standing talking to the assassin. Or at least he said there were three people there. So I do believe that there was a swap there, that Palma was swapped with a double, that Palma was taken in through the entrance in the Scandia building and down into the tunnel. And the double went in and met up. And there's a possibility that even Lisbeth was a double as well.
Hmm.
Anyway, so they continue walking up, and the shooter, which is not many people think that the Korim Amanen is this Antti Avsan that I mentioned before. He was the guy standing there the minutes before. He had a walkie-talkie under one arm and a revolver under the other. And two Finnish women saw him standing there, and they recognized him from a gym in northern Stockholm. And they recognized him because he's from Estonia, so they knew that he spoke Finnish. So one of them just went up and said, "Excuse me, do you know what time it is?" She asked in Finnish. And he looked just like he looked stunned and didn't answer. So she repeated again and said, "Excuse me, but do you know what time it is?" At that time, they heard in the walkie-talkie, it said, and he said, "I've been recognized. What should I do?" And somebody else answers in Finnish saying, "Just do what you have to do." That time. When these women heard that, they thought there was some kind of drug deal going down, so they turned away and walked away, and they got a bit scared. And they continued down the road a couple of hundred meters, and then boom, boom, they heard the shots. So they were very afraid and thought that he was the one that had shot him. But as far as I've been able to figure out, he was, after he had been recognized, they swapped him with the real shooter, who I mentioned before, this Turkish Kurd. Mm-hmm. His code name for this operation was Abdul Kassem.
Hmm.
Anyway, so, but Abdul Kassem was standing there on the corner after being exchanged with a revolver with fake ammo, thinking that it was real. So when Palme and his wife passed him, he walked up behind them, put his hand on his shoulder, and fired one shot into the back of him with fake ammo. The double started to faking falling down, but just as he fell more or less in the same second as he fired one shot into his back, the sniper on the other side of the street fired one shot with a fine caliber, high velocity rifle from the front, killing this person. So we actually have a real assassination happening, but with a bullet hole coming from the wrong direction.
Hmm.
You see? Yeah. This is also what Jörgen Svensson, who was part of the one of the commissions that afterwards, he withdrew and said, I can't be part of this because there's a massive, there's something totally wrong here, because he was actually killed with a shot of a fine caliber, high velocity bullet from the front.
Hmm.
You see that?
What a mess.
This is also why they have a massive problem with the autopsy, because there was no shot fired from behind. And also, if he had been shot the way they say, they officially say, his vertebrae, was cut off by the shot, you know. So he would actually just fold forward. His body, there would be nothing to hold him. He would just like fold forward and drop dead right away. But here the witnesses see that he goes down on his knees and then he falls down.
Mm-hmm.
Not what he should have had he been hit by a .357 Magnum.
Yeah.
Then we have Lisbeth Palme, or the double, thinks that it's fake, but he's actually dead, this person, okay? The shooter on the street level thinks that he killed him, which he didn't, and he starts running. He fires a second shot, fake bullet, after Lisbeth, which doesn't hit her because there's nothing to hit her, and then runs up the stairs, and up the stairs where he's met by Carl Gustav Östling, if you remember, the guy who is the spider in the web, who takes care. They have an exchange of passwords, and then he hands over the gun, and he then continues running past the Johannes Brandstation, not where the official story is, that he went straight down David Borgers gata. Instead, he turned left after delivering the gun, turned left past the fire station, continued about 100 meters, then down the stairs, and there he was picked up in this light blue Volkswagen Passat that was driven by Franz Esser. That they then took off and went north together with the other one of the other escape cars, the white Volvo 242, and they then met further up on one of the main highways. They stopped there and they swapped, took a bag with clothes and weapons and everything, threw it in the other car. The killer got in the first car and then they took off. One car, I think, went to Norway, as far as I know, and the other one went up to Björklinge, where he was... No, first they went to Rosersberg, a small village north of Stockholm, northeast, and outside there in a barn, they were met up by a backup team from Stay Behind, or Ola Gryning, what I think this part was called.
Mm.
They went into this barn, which is owned by the royal family or the royal estate. It's a perfect barn. I've been able to track it down. There's no windows. There's no nothing. And normally it's filled with military equipment. But there they were called in. They gave a password. And they exchanged, they took, got rid of all the evidence, they changed plates on the car and so on. And then after that, they drove up to Björklinge, where they were hiding out until, I think, around the 3rd of March, which is a few days after the assassination. And then when everything cooled down a bit, they were taken out with diplomatic papers and flown out that way.
Okay.
So we have a bit of a problem here, because the Palme team thought that it was a fake assassination. And so they take this body, which, and the guy was dead at the site, because I know police chief Gösta Söderström, who is a very honest man and the first man on site there. He went up there not recognizing Olof Palme. He couldn't recognize him at all. He had no idea, because this guy was covered in blood. His face was covered in blood. And so he saw right away that this guy was dead. But just to make sure, he put his finger on his open eye, you know, to see, check the reflex. And there was nothing. This guy was gone. But before that, Lisbeth Palme, who was running around there screaming and being, you know, hysterical, when a nurse came, there was a nurse called Anna Hage who came as a witness and started trying to help Olof Palme. They were trying to give him, mouth-to-mouth resurrection. They were trying to get going. When they started doing that, Lisbeth pulled them away from him. You know, why did she do that? Yeah. Why wouldn't she do anything to help her husband? But if it wasn't her husband, there's a reason why she was pulling them away, you see?
Yeah.
Because they would see that this was not the guy. And Gösta didn't even recognize Lisbeth Palme, even though he knew her well. But he said afterwards, I had no idea. But it was, she said, "Can't you see who I am? I'm Lisbeth Palme, and there lies my Olof," was what she said.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when that body was taken to the hospital, it was delayed for like 5-6 minutes. The ambulance didn't go straight there. And when it arrived, Lisbeth Palme came in a police car, not in the ambulance that she had entered first, and in a different coat as well. Okay?
Yeah.
So we still more strange things. And when this body was pulled in, one of the nurses afterwards said, it was so strange because he didn't really look like Olof Palme, and he was much bigger than I thought. You know, once again, question mark.
Let's finish up also the story here, first of all, but we need to get to what actually happened with the real Olof Palme, where he went.
After the assassination, it was said that the whole Sweden was in shock and so on. And one of the first thing that Ingvar Carlsson, the vice prime minister, said, he gave Ebbe Carlsson, who was Mr. No One, nobody, he gave him an order to get hold of Olof Palme's youngest son, who at that point were in on ski holiday in Chamonix in southern France. He said it's of utmost importance to get him home as soon as possible. Why? No idea. His youngest guy, he was only like 16 or something like that. Okay, so how did he do that? Did Ebbe Carlsson get in touch with SAS or the travel agency to get him home? No. He called the French Prime Minister, François Mitterrand. No, the French President, François Mitterrand, and his Prime Minister, Laurent Fabius, and was able to get them to give him a private jet plane. It was a Mystery 20, it's called, from the GLAM. The GLAM fleet is the presidential fleet of airplanes. And with this plane, officially, he and Carl Lidbom, if you remember Carl Lidbom, the ambassador, also the advisor for Olof Palme, these two people went to Chamonix to pick up Matthias. It's just that we have some problems here, because Chamonix at that time did not have an airstrip. You know, so a plane landing where you cannot land, problem.
That's right.
When confronted with that later, Lidbom changed his story and said that they flew to Geneva and then drove there by car, but no one ever saw them there either. So then the story was changed again, and one time they flew to Paris and Villa Coublou, I think it was called. It just kept changing. And in the meantime, none have seen Ebbe Carlsson or Carl Lidbom for more or less 3 days, from the Friday that he was assassinated until Monday morning, we're talking the French ambassador or the Swedish ambassador in France. He was not there at the embassy when all people contacted them and, you know, presidents called and whatever. He was not there. No one saw him. And he has given many different explanations what he was doing, but none of them really adds up. What I believe happened was that this plane was not used to go and pick up his son. His son was put there to have a reason for the plane to go there, but that he was actually, they were actually using it to fly out with Olof Palme. And there's a very, very good Swedish investigator called Sven Anér, who's also written a whole book about this. It's called The Mystery, The Chamonix Scam.
Yeah.
He was able to track this flight and see that there was one unidentified male person on board there. So it seems like Olof Palme was taken possibly to Falun or Bromma, I'm not sure which airport in Sweden, and then flown up from there to somewhere in the south of France where he was received and then taken care of in, I would think, in one of these big castles or somewhere down there. And then later on, I think it was on Sunday or something like that, Matthias were flown home with a normal plane. But when approached by a German TV crew some years afterwards, they asked Matthias Palme, how did you get home that evening? You know, it should be a very innocent question, very easy to answer. And Matthias said, I don't think I'm mentally strong enough to answer that question.
Yeah, that's right.
Also, when you looked at the three brothers were on Skavlan, a TV show not long ago, and they, if you look at them, they look really scared, especially Matthias. Hmm. So what are they scared of? Then also you got, after the assassination, Lisbeth Palme did quite a few trips to France. Officially, she was involved with different charity work and so for children and so on. But I spoke to one who used to work with her, and there were some of these trips that they were not needed, you know, and there were strange things around how they were financed and so on. And also she was given the highest order, a medal of the Swedish queen, the highest that you can get in Sweden. For what? For what? Why?
Mm.
And Mona Sahlin, you know, one of the very high social democrats in Sweden as well, when she was asked what women she really admired, she said, number one, Mother Teresa. Number two, Lisbeth Palme.
Mm.
Once again, very strange answer, I would say. Mm. Also, you have... I told you about Morten, not the youngest son, but the middle son, the guy that they went to the cinema with this evening. When he found out that his dad had been shot, he went straight to their apartment, to his parents' apartment in Gamla Stan in Stockholm. And he didn't have the key, so he went to the neighbor's door and knocked on the door, because that guy he used to water the plants and so on. He got the keys from this guy, went into the apartment, and according to the neighbor, he was in there for like 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes, looking for something. The neighbor heard this noise like he was pulling out drawers and stuff like that. And then after that, Morten Palme went down and was picked up by a police car that was waiting outside and driven off somewhere. The only way that this makes any sense is if Palme was on his way to leave the country and this whole operation was starting, and that he had forgotten something. What could he forget that would be that important at that time? His passport? No, because officially he was dead, so that didn't really matter. He was also flown out on diplomatic ways. But there's one thing that has disappeared. It's his diary. His diary has been asked for by many people, and there's never been any real explanation for what happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was known to keep a very detailed diary. And in my opinion, that diary would have been telling the whole story about the setup and therefore been crucial to be picked up and sent with him or destroyed or whatever,
yeah.
but getting rid of before any kind of investigation could start.
Yeah, so that's not like, can't be lying around in his place there and so for someone to find, obviously. Yeah.
No, exactly.
Yeah. Huh.
So I tell you, to come to a conclusion, I've been digging into this for like 25 years, and to this day, I don't even know if there's anyone in the grave in Stockholm, I tell you. I would not be surprised if that grave was empty. Yeah. I know this is a big thing to say, but...
Well, you know, it's happened before, disappearances and people who are, you know, they want to just remove themselves in different ways, and the more high profile you are, the more difficult it is, of course. How yeah. long then do you think that Palme actually survived? Is there any way of knowing that? Let's speculate a little bit. What do you think happened to him?
Wild speculations, totally wild, is that I think he might have died in Toronto in Canada around 1996. But these are wild speculations.
Okay, tell us about why those are your conclusions.
If I do that, I will uncover sources that I don't want to. But this is just a wild speculation. But I really think that he survived that assassination and
got out.
That this is if, like they say, if the truth about this come forward, it would shake Sweden in its foundation. Because then we're talking about a coup d'etat, I mean, a government that has not been elected by the people. You know, they have gotten rid of him, and they put a government there on their own behalf. You know.
And, oh, sure,
and,
sure.
And if you look, the prime ministers who have followed, like Ingvar Carlsson, and also Fredrik Reinfeldt now is a Bilderberger. Mona Sahlin, Bilderberger. Ingvar Carlsson, I've never seen him on any Bilderberg list, but I know that he was working for the Kissinger Associates afterwards, which is more or less the same. And he also, there was one thing very interesting about his way of resigning, because there was a lot of talk about the, I think it was Kjell Olof Feldt, the former Minister of Finance, who went out in the newspaper Dagens Nyheter and said, we need to investigate the police trail, the connection with the police, the right-wing police. He went out there. Then at this very same evening or night, there were two people crawling around on top of the prime minister's house on the roof of the where he lived,
mm-hmm.
even though it's with loads of cameras, high security, all of that. They were allowed to run around on the roof for quite a while, and in the end, they were picked up by somebody called, I think it was Securitas or some private security company, who came and picked them up. But they were never booked in the police station. They were released right away, these two men. So I don't know who they were. But what happened was the very next morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, Ingvar Carlsson calls Mona Sahlin and says, I want to resign. No explanation. I just want to resign. Please arrange for a press conference, which he did. And when he came to that press conference, he was on crutches. And it was said that it was from playing tennis or something like that. possible, but I would not be surprised if he had been scared off somehow. Because one thing also I need to mention is, one thing that most people have forgotten is that after the assassination, it seems like the members of the Palme team were not paid off because they had not actually killed him. So they were sort of tricked, and they got very, very upset about this. So they started like a wave of terror against Swedish society. And if you check the papers from, or I think it's around the summer of 86, there was a, I can't remember how many people were threatened with death threats, you know, in key positions, high positions.
Yeah.
And the chief of police, he went out and said, we're being occupied by this terror group, and there's a major alert, major alarm. We know who did the assassination, and we're very afraid of them. At the same time, Carlid Boom was staying in his embassy house in Paris, and he and his wife were gassed, you know, sprayed with gas. There were eight people that came into the building and sprayed them with gas, and they said they took nothing. But when Carlid Boom was later interviewed about it, he was just laughing and said, well, it wouldn't have mattered if we had machine guns, guards with machine guns. They would have gotten in anyway. And anyway, they didn't take anything, not even my wallet. But during this wave of terror, there was quite a few bombs that were set off in, as well. And there was the American ambassador, Greg Newell. He had a party around midsummer. And at that party, suddenly they were attacked by two people. One of the security guards opened fire against one of them and said that he had seen a rifle and so on. There was a lot of strange things going on that had to do with this assassination. If you trust what people from the hit team has written in their letters, which has been sent to the authorities, but are not really official. They're there, but they're hidden in tons of other papers. So you really need to look hard for these things.
What do you think, Ulle, would take to really open up this case? Let's say that there are documents out there about some of the activity that has been going on. Let's say that someone hacking into the systems, a kind of a WikiLeaks thing or what have you. Do you think it's something like of that caliber that it would take at this stage to attain more information about this? Or, I mean, there's still people around. There's still people who could talk, I guess. But the chances of that happening are pretty slim, I guess.
Yeah, most of the key people are dead already. Like Östling died, and he died very young in Berlin, as far as I've heard. To alcohol-related diseases, whatever that is. And Carlid Boom died a few years ago. It's said that he died in his sofa in front of the TV, but I've been told by inside information, inside sources, that he actually committed suicide or was shot by a pistol. That I need to look into more. But like I said, most people who are involved in these things, they very often end up they get a violent end. So what would, I mean, if it would be possible maybe to take an X-ray of the grave and see if there's actually anyone in there. And if there is anyone in there, if the height and so on would fit Olof Palme, you know, or if it's the double that is there.
Yeah, exactly.
A thing like that, it would need a thing like that to uncover it, I think, to make it obvious. But I tell you, I'm not the only one who's been drawing these conclusions. I mean, there's been rumors about that he staged his own suicide since day one. And in, I think it was 1987, I think, a social democrat who was quite way up in the hierarchy, his name was Sven Wernström, he wrote a book called The Murder, a Bull and Cock Story, you know, like Mordet en rövarhistoria, and it's written like almost like a Dan Brown novel, but in a very, very simple, almost childish way. But what he does is he describes everything more or less that I've been telling you about, but in a story, it happens in South America in one of these republics. And I approached him in 1989, I think, asking him about what is this, you know, because this book was very, very hard to get hold of. And the libraries, it was labeled a kid's book, So you couldn't find it among normal books. They labeled it a kid's book for some strange reason, or a reason not to be able to find it, I would say. And he got very nervous when I started asking him about it and didn't want to answer any questions. He just said, read the book and draw your own conclusions. Then about a year ago or two ago, there was another book called The Secret Scenario of the Palme Assassination, Double Play and Coup d'Etat. It is written about a man called Hans Liljesson, and he used to be a very close associate to Carl Lidbom. He was working at the embassy in Paris at the time of the assassination. And it was Carl Lidbom's very strange ways that made him sort of suspicious. What is going on? Because he right away started asking questions like anyone would do the days following the assassination. And Carl Lidbom, just his way of answering was, like I said, very strange and dubious. And so this guy really started looking into it. He's also a former lawyer and he used to work at way up in the military with Öbe, the commander in chief of the defense. And so this is just not just anyone. And he's saying more or less identical, the same thing as I am here, but not the thing about Olof Palme having AIDS. He said that Olof Palme was under a murder threat. He might be thinking of the NATO team. And that they wanted to, the only way that he could avoid being actually assassinated was by dying before they got to him. And so they set this whole thing up to get away, you know, and still survive the hit.
Yeah, I mean, we've done some programs on HIV and AIDS and such, and exploring some of the ideas that it's certainly it's an immune issue that arises, deficiency, if you will, of the autoimmune system, but it also is related to the lifestyle, primarily with drug use primarily and things like that, and even a promiscuous, well, above a promiscuous lifestyle. But nonetheless, if these are you know symptoms, if you will, that he had or that he still has some health issues, it's kind of, it just on top of everything, that's really would be one of the incentives of why he would want to try to get out. But just as you said, Ulla, it's not really the central issue after all to it. It's more that he might have been in a position where he's threatened.
I think this is what would explain the whole thing, and it would also explain why the family would be willing to go along with this, because the shame would be so hard on the family and hit the Palme family so hard.
Yeah. Why is it, do you think, that they have not played more than on the, I guess, the fake greatness of Palme, with more statues, a square in Stockholm, you know, days named after him, what have you? It seems then on one level that they're, sure, they're proud of him and they want to raise him up, but they, at the same time, they kind of want to cover it up and not bring any attention to it. So it's like it's an ambivalent kind of attitude here, right?
Yeah, but are they proud of him? Or do they see him as a traitor? I just get a feeling that the less said, the better, you know? Don't even mention him. Don't, just forget about it.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, don't look into it. Don't, any museums, don't remind people of him. I mean, the only thing is this thing in the payment, this sign saying here is where Olof Palme was murdered, and they almost didn't want that either. And also, you know, we were talking about the use of doubles when it actually happened. That could also be an explanation why Lisbeth Palme did not take part of the reconstruction of the crime. You know, when they went through her story, she was not part of the reconstruction. She was not there. So the witnesses didn't see her, meaning that I think the witnesses would have recognized and said, listen, this is not the woman who was here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And also, when the trial was going on, she totally refused that there would be any tape recordings of her voice, any filming, any coverage, anything. You know, she didn't want the press to be there. She didn't want any audience to be there. Now they had to have public audience in there according to Swedish law, but the whole press section was put in another room with a delay on the sound, so that they could, there was a, I think, 6 second delay, so that if anything came out that she said something wrong, they could just stop it, you know. And the press was like, they horrified, the international press said, oh, we can't believe this is going on. Why did she demand a thing like that? Would it be that otherwise there could be witnesses in the audience, or the sound of her voice? Or you tell me, but they're very strange things. And also, one of the people who supposedly have taken part of the autopsy, a female, her name is Kari Ulmstad, she went out and started talking about the different things about his disease and, or this virus thing, whatever it was. They claimed that it had to do with his, I think, his kidneys or something like that. But the oldest son, Joakim Palme, threatened to sue her, or maybe he even sued her, I'm not sure. Why? And also, the main doctor who did the autopsy, his name was Milan Valverius. He was the one who wrote the address on the death certificate, an address that does not exist. There's, well, the street exists, but there are not that many houses on the street. So it's and it's a totally different one than where the prime minister lived. He also claimed, he went out in the press and said, the whole truth is in the autopsy protocol, whatever he meant with that. And then, after a while, when he continued saying that, he ended up committing suicide together with his wife on the same day. They say that he had cancer and that the couple decided to commit suicide in a romantic type of way together. But to me, it could might as well be that they were taken care of. I would put money on the last one.
Wow.
There's also more things, strange things, if you have time.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Let's like, lay it all out there.
You know, like when after Palme was dead, his body was taken to the coroner, yeah. And while it was there, there was a bomb threat to the place, the coroner's office. Yeah. And after that, inside sources says that the body disappeared for 2 days before the funeral, that they didn't know where the body was, and then. It was found out nära Södra Skogs kyrkogården, just south of Stockholm. That was where the car, what do you call these, one of these cars where take dead bodies, I don't know. That was found with a body in it, parked out there. What is
that? That's ridiculous. Is that true? Do you think that's true?
This is, as far as I've been informed, that is what happened. But would that happen if it was actually Olof Palme's real body, or would they take the body away because people would recognize it, you know?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Take it away, and then once the funeral is there, bring in the body, boof, down the grave, out of the way.
Well, I could do the swap pretty easy if it's been gone missing for 2 days.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, there's so many... But in my opinion, the story I've told over these few hours here pulls together the dots, you know? There's so many of these strange things that suddenly make sense instead of just being mysteries.
Well, the overall... it would explain the confusion that no one knows what the heck is going on. There is a wall, as you say, somewhere of mixed between... The people in place and the bureaucracy and everything, but there's like no one, no matter how many new investigators are trying to look into it, or journalists, or you know, police people that are in charge of investigating, it never is. There's never anything coming out of anything of it. Really, I mean, if you think about it, by this stage, we would have solved this thing. But it's pretty evident that someone is actively doing everything that they can to cover it up, to make it more confusing, with leads and everything. And it would explain also why there are so many different kind of versions, if you will, of things that have been happening. So you have these different teams, for example, which would explain quite a bit, where there's even within the ranks confusion of who is going to do what. And the question is, I mean, as we've been trying to get to here, the question is, who has the whole truth? Maybe there is so many things running that no one person alone has the entire truth. You know what I mean?
Do you know Bernd Carlsson, who was he was working very high up for the United Nations, was also a near colleague of Olof Palme. He said, 4 days before his death, he said, "I'm one of the very few people who know what actually happened to Olof Palme." And then a few days later, he told his girlfriend this. And then a few days later, he was on the plane that exploded above Lockerbie, you know, the Pan Am 103.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of evidence showing that the bomb was placed in a tape recorder in his luggage and was placed by one of the accomplices of Craig Williamson, a guy called Eben Barlow, who was the one who got it into his luggage on the Heathrow airport. No, so the people who knew the whole picture, all of them are dead, you know.
Yeah, and then Gaddafi took the blame for that.
One more thing.
Yeah.
Do you remember the crazy Austrian guy, Wilhelm Kram, that had been prepared as a patsy?
Yeah.
I think what made the whole confusion with the delays and everything, all of these things that turned this whole thing into a massive mess, was that right the minute when he was supposed to be picked up, just a few minutes after Olof Palme had been shot, the team A, the Palmer group, they went to get this patsy. But when they went to get him, he had been stopped by a police car, another police car. So these police were standing talking to him, giving him an alibi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so suddenly from the Palmer team having a perfect patsy that they could just boom, take and pin the whole thing on, this guy had a watertight alibi, you know. And that from just messed everything up. And that is why the whole delay overnight, you know, where who should they blame? Who suddenly they have a dead person with a bullet hole from the wrong direction. It's just total confusion. And that is why everything is delayed overnight.
Yeah.
And then this crazy Austrian guy is seen just 10 minutes later. He walks into the restaurant exactly where the real killer was picked up in the light blue Volkswagen Passat, you know, in exactly the same spot. There's a restaurant there called Karelia. So the shooter takes off in the escape car, and just a few minutes later, the scapegoat, the setup patsy, walks into the exact restaurant where he took off. And I think that as soon as the police car that was standing talking to Wilhelm Kram, as far as I know, that one has never been identified. And I think that one belonged to the NATO team, just destroying Team A's plans, you know?
I see, yeah.
And as soon as that took off, another police car came connected to the Olof Palme team, came and picked up Wilhelm Kram and drove him straight to restaurant Karelia so that they could connect him there to the assassination, you know, so that he could be picked up there, saying that instead of getting into a car, he went into the restaurant and therefore he was the one who did it. But it all got messed up overnight. And that is the whole mess that has then continued and continued and continued.
Yeah. I wanted to return to a point as well that you mentioned earlier in regards to how they create these heroes or the people and martyrs to a certain degree. It's happened obviously with people like Che Guevara, and now even more recently with Chavez, and you have Martin Luther King and Bob Marley. We talked about the assassination of him too last time. And this is kind of, it seems to be how they run things. And certainly with JFK, just the comparison there alone, but this statement who is like in the officialdom put as like this untouchable, just miracle man, and nothing is wrong with them. They're just, you know, saints basically. And then they do take them out at that point. You have these right wing networks coming in there, taking out these people, effectively also creating kind of a mythology almost around these people. And these are the people that are, you know, from a historical perspective, almost, you know, worshipped to a certain degree. So what I'm seeing is as well on top of things is almost like it's the creation of a sort of a religion, but it's tied to the system of politics, if you will, kind of the royalty of our time, almost in a way.
Yeah. No, but they've studied history and seen what happened, you know, like Martin Luther King, whoop, Saint JFK, Saint Marilyn Monroe, Saint, these, they become myths.
Yeah.
You know, so, so they really, I think the plan is good. You know, let's turn Oliver Palmer into one as well. He was, in my opinion, I mean, he was hated by a lot of people and loved by some. I didn't think he was a very nice person. I never really liked him, but that's not just my personal. But he was not the type of person you would think could make a myth of a saint. But that is what he was turned into.
That's right. That's what they always do. It's quite the reverse in history. We talked about that last time as well. So what does this to you say about Swedish politics, corruption, lies, and deceit, and where if this is the foundation of our system that it's built on these kinds of things? What does that hold for the future of Sweden? I'd like your more philosophical thoughts on all this, as you've been kind of wallowing in this material for over 20 years now, Ola.
I don't see this as a Swedish occurrence, you know. Okay, it happened in Sweden, but it just shows that Sweden is just a tiny little part of a much, much bigger jigsaw, a much bigger global game where this global elite has been playing ping pong with our brains for so many, many years. And it's just, like you said, if you start looking into so many different occurrences, everything from the moon landing hoax or Titanic or how Hitler wasn't killed or committed suicide but escaped, and you, all of these, like they really are masters of illusion, puppet masters playing with us without us noticing. But at the same time, when you look into it, they look like they're invincible, that they will always be ruling us, because they're officially so powerful. But the thing is that it's only like a couple of thousand people in total in this elite group, and we're like 9 billions and more. So it's absolutely a total joke that we're letting us control like this. So, but I'm extremely positive about the future. I think it's just a matter of time. It's falling apart for them. And I think now you see the Pope said, whoops, the boat is sinking, I'm out. And the Queen Beatrix said, whoops, I'm out, you know, before it's too late. I think, and all of these courts around the world who have started to take up cases against George Bush and Kissinger and all of these things, where the whole thing is being done in front of an international court, and they're sentenced for crimes against humanity. I think it's big steps forward. And I think that is why also they're getting desperate, and that's why we're seeing a lot of these Sandy Hook or the Boston Marathon. They're speeding it up because they think they're running out of time, which they are. And so I'm very positive. I think it's just keep the focus, believe in truth and harmony, and just let it stop the madness. I think many of these people are very scared, you know, because now when it's falling apart, they think that we will tear them to pieces and take out a cruel revenge. But in my opinion, I just want it to stop, you know. Let the madness stop. It's enough. We've had enough, you know. Just leave us alone and let this world turn into the paradise it was meant to be. You know, people just want peace and harmony, friends, wonderful times together, and enjoy nature and life.
Yeah, it's a good point. I've always wondered what it is that is driving some of these people. When you look around in the world, most people just want to live their lives. They want to take it easy, have some good times, but some of these maniacs out there are driven in a completely different way. And ultimately, as you said as well, I think it's theatrics, and the majority of the problems arise, I believe, when people are drawn into these theatrics, when they are ready to fight either over their heroes or the events that are said to have taken place. Sometimes they even get into the absurdity of fighting over the words, you know, as Robert Anton Wilson many times said, this is all about interpretation of both events but also history, and then people fight with each other about that, it's like a football game ultimately. We have a red team and a blue team, you know, which one do you associate with, which one is your team, and then people are ready to kill each other over these manipulated and fake theatrical, you know, teams that are there ultimately to steal your attention, your time, your energy, your money, everything, you know. So if people step away from it and with non-compliance just walk away from the theater of the world of politics and everything else, and basically begin to handle their own, deal with their own business first of all, I think we're going to come a long way. And I mean, these examples that you've mentioned to us that we've talked about during this series is a wonderful example, absolutely wonderful example of the extent that they go to set up these, you know, hot air balloons filled with nothing but hot air. It's theater. It's nothing else. It's like a game show. And of course, real people's lives are drawn into it. I'm not saying that. It has real consequences and effects in the world. But ultimately, if there wasn't a system tied so collectively around these politicians and all these rules and laws that they've set up, it would be a whole different game on this planet. I completely agree with that.
Turn off the TV. Start taking care of your family. You know, start, go out, help people, do something good, be useful, peaceful, easeful. You know, instead of let them playing around with your brain and taking part of it. Because we are all, as long as we're sleeping, we're being part of it. You know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think it's amazing with internet, because now it goes so fast. Even in the old days when I started with this, it was easy to shut up people, you know. Somebody knew too much, kill him. Story over, bomb, goodbye. And that was also when it was very dangerous for somebody like myself, because you could very easily be taken out. But now it just goes so fast that minutes after something happened, you've got cameras everywhere. People got mobile phones, they film from all different angles. I mean, they created the internet, but the internet is one of the things that are going to bring them down as well. That's why they're trying to shut it down in so many different ways. So, I would say disconnect with the TV, you know. Stop being pumped with all this crap, because there's a lot of crap being pumped in. It's called programs and not it's called for a reason, because it really is programming your head in the wrong direction. So get some distance, go out in the air, get back into reality, and also get away from the iPhone, start being with your friends and take care of each other instead of this nonsense that is going on.
Very good. Now, any other, I guess, last words for this time, Ulla, as we wrap up with these four shows we've done together? Obviously, I want to give a huge thanks to you for doing this with us, and it's been my pleasure to be able to host this and facilitate this, because it's a lot of interesting material. It's a subject close to my heart because of my country, Sweden, and everything that... all the bullshit, basically, that goes on there, and anything that shreds the lies on the international scene of what Sweden is, have been, or is going to be, I'm very interested in. So I'm really grateful for that. Yeah, if there's anything else, Ola, please go ahead and give us those details. Obviously, again, we want to hear about your website. We want to urge people to donate to you and pick up a copy of the book. It's free right there from Ola's website to download. And again, just check out the index in the back there as well, because there are tons of different names here. And these networks I've been talking about, they're, you know, involved in the business in other countries as well, are named right there. And it's some really interesting stuff. And you have a great article on the Pegasus Files as well. I have an article on the website about, you know, Project Pegasus as well. But tons of interesting stuff that connects more on the international scene of things. So I highly do recommend it. Coup d'etat in slow motion. But I'll leave the last few words to you, Ola.
No, it's available both in Swedish and English, but the English version I've updated a lot. It's almost 200 pages more. And those pages, to a large extent, is a membership list of the Bilderberg Group all the way from 1954 all the way up until now. And also a list of members in the Committee of 300. And also updated more since what has happened the last 10 years, even though officially it's very little, and officially it will be very little until this whole thing is uncovered in its own, in the whole essence. But I've got, I'm a Raja Yoga student and teacher, which is the science of the mind, not all of these strange postures. And I've got this beautiful, beautiful teacher called Nelani Chalaram, and she's got this like a prayer, and it says, "May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who hurt us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light." That is how I feel, you know. Let's just stop it. And there's very often when you see a revolution somewhere or something, they're getting rid of a very violent and brutal dictator. Within a few years, the people who overthrown them, they're just as bad.
Yeah, you know? So, that's
so
right.
We need to stop it. We need to stop that loop, that vicious circle.
Well, so they call it, sorry, Ola, but they call it revolution for a reason. It means go around, do a circle. It's a circle. We're stuck in the loop. Revolution.
Thank you for that one. I never thought of that. Perfect. So what I think the way to go is what they did in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation, the whole movement there, where it's a matter of forgiveness. You know, come forward, confess what you have done, reveal the secrets so that people will see what's going on, let the wounds heal, you know, and let after that, let's see if we can forgive each other and move on as brothers and sisters. You know, that is the way. Because these people have done a lot of cruel things. They're behind so much, if not all of the madness going on. Wars and terror acts and all of these things. So awful stuff. But we to be able to move on, we need to do the same as in South Africa, I think. That is the way to go. Anyway, my website is the three W's .murderofpalme.com. That is murderofpalme.com. The title of my book is Coup d'etat in slow motion, or Statskupp in slow motion. And like Henrik so kindly mentioned, there's a donation button, which I really appreciate if people use it. I'm in a bit of a tough situation, because when you get into this, you need to spend so many thousands of hours and no income in. On the contrary, you get a lot of heat on you, so it's not easy to survive, but I've done that. And any appreciation is very, very appreciated. And that's about it.
All right. Well, you heard a man. Go to the website and do take a look around there. Very good. Great stuff. Thanks again for your time, Ola, and for your work. Let's have you back at some point as well and talk about some of the other work.
And also thank you, Henrik, for all of the things you do for the world. It's so appreciated, I tell you.
And there we go. We hope that you've enjoyed this series. We can't thank Ola or you enough for making it all happen. It's with you, our supporter, that this becomes possible. And we do value the possibility to be able to pull all of these threads together in one place by making this program and the website for you to enjoy and hopefully learn a whole lot more from, just as we are learning tremendous amounts making it. Harry Hubbard is next on Red Ice Radio on the mystery of the Illinois caves and the strange story of how a powerful Ptolemaic dynasty and their artifacts from the Mediterranean ended up in Marion County in Illinois. After this, we'll discuss the Boston bombings and get a geopolitical analysis from Peter Henningsen from 21stCenturyWire.com. For Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and myself, thank you to all our friends out there. Have a great rest of your day or evening, and we will be back with more soon.
Right into the sun with me. Then give it all away for free. Right into the sun with me. And I'll show. Oh,